Welcome to the Immigration Hour on America's Web Radio. It's great to be with you. Another beautiful day. I don't know if you know this, but immigration is back playing a role in the election. You know, it's never ceases to amaze me, David, that we have this weird fascination with immigration over the last, probably about 8 years or so in the United States, maybe a decade or so, to use it as a political weapon when, while many people believe it impacts their lives, for many people there is no real impact in their lives, but the perception that immigration somehow negatively impacts people drives people to the polls. And since all politicians care about from both parties is being reelected. Is that right, David? That's pretty accurate. All they really care about is being reelected. Very few of them care about actually doing good. There are some, but most of them don't. They just want to get reelected.
No, let me throw something.
You don't agree with me? David, I thought you definitely agree with me.
No, I totally agree with you. We elect one person, and we get a different person. But yeah, one thing that I've noticed over the years is, and I think this is our fault. I don't know exactly how we do all of this, but they get to Washington, and, you know, you've heard the term drinking the Kool-Aid. You know, I got a feeling that they're human beings that we elect, and just like all the rest of us, we succumb to something or the other, and they get bombarded by the lobbyists, and they're offered so much, and, you know, that they...
Well, I think part of the problem, David, is that money is the mother's milk of politics.
Yep.
And even in congressional races, you know, the congressman that we elect...
Well, it's even at a state level.
Well, state level, I'm going to get into that in a second, but at the congressional level, it's going to cost you $3 to $5 million to run for election or more. And, you know, I don't know about you, David, but I don't sit around with $3 to $5 million in my pocket saying, I think I'll spend $3 or $5 million so I can get a job that pays me $170,000 a year. You know, the reality is they have to work for the day they get elected until the next reelection. They are literally seeking money every single day if they want to stay in power. Now, there are the odd exceptions, either they're very wealthy or those that say, elect me, don't elect me, I don't care, but I'm not going to spend a lot of money on my campaign. Those districts are very hard to find these days where they don't have to campaign. And so every day politicians are having to say, well, give me money. Well, and the only way you give money to people, David, you have to believe. What?
What do I get for it?
Well, that's a question. That's exactly the question. What am I getting for my money? Why am I going to give you money? Do you reflect what I believe? Or will you be able to do something for me that will enrich me in some way? So either it's an altruistic belief, I believe that you have to do something that's good for me or for America, or it's a personal, what can you do for me kind of thing. Most of it, the big money tends to be lobbyists, which specific industries, what can you do for me, like the private prison industry that gives millions of dollars a year to politicians so they can beef up detentions around the country. And there are those that, I mean, there are those that give money that say, well, I want better people in politics. Those people give $10. You don't get reelected on $10. Yeah, you might raise $1 million from 10,000 different people, $10 a piece, but you're not going to compete in a federal race for $1 million. You're just not. And so that's, I think, part of the problem. And then you have immigration that plays into that, because people will give you $10, Dave, if you go out and say, immigrants are bad for America. We need to build the wall. Build the wall. Here's $100 to help you build the wall, David. And literally, so far this campaign season, David, you're going to believe this, there's been spent around the country $150 million on campaign ads dealing with immigration. Just immigration. That doesn't count all campaign ads, obviously. But just campaign ads with immigration, $150 million. Now, most of that, of course, is spending by Republicans on building the wall and echoing the same strains. But it's the ads that you look at this are tend to be those that try to demonize immigrants, to try to pit Americans against immigrants, and thus try to mobilize people to the polls, because somehow by voting for candidate X, you're going to stop whatever you think immigration is bad about immigration going forward. So far this year, In House, Senate, and governor races, there's been $124 million spent on 280,000 immigration-related TV spots. Wow. Now, here's what's interesting, David. That's five times more than was spent in the last midterms, where there was 44,000 spots for about $23 million. Now, think about that. What has changed? And even, David, go back to 2016 in the national election. There was less than 100,000 television spots on immigration and around $40 million spent. So this year, it's been extraordinary spending on immigration. And yet, people don't view immigration as important as, generally speaking, health care, taxes, unemployment, government spending, and corruption. And yet, why is this coming up as part of the spending? For example, David, in Indiana, now Indiana, of course, is right on the border next to Texas. You're a Texas guy. How long is it? I mean, that's like a block away from Texas, right? Indiana's right there, and they're right on the border fighting all the Mexicans coming in, trying to steal our babies and marry our women and read our Bibles and stuff, right? Well, in Indiana, 43% of the ads, 43% war on immigration. Michigan, where, of course, you have the huge influx of Canadians coming across the border, stealing all our jobs, destroying American values, 35% of the ads are immigration ads. Kentucky, which I will tell you without immigration would end up not having any horses or bluegrass, 28% of the ads dealt with immigration. And of those ads, I'm not talking about, hey, immigration's great for America. Oh, my gosh, we need more immigration. No. These ads are all anti-immigration ads. That's an enormous sum of money, coming up. And people say, well, the reason is Trump. This is a president who got elected on this topic, who constantly brings it up, who uses a stirrup as base, and proposes some crazy but highly controversial things, including putting children in children's jails and separating them from their parents. It really is stunning. So, you know, here's a great example. Joe Donnelly, who is a Democrat trying to keep his seat, he is running ads showing that he voted for Trump's wall three times. Now, I don't know how close to the wall Indiana is, but I'm pretty sure it's not in the state. But I'm like 99% sure it's like maybe almost 2,000 miles from the state. And yet, here they are running ads, Democrats too, but mostly Republicans, to mobilize voters, to kind of get them out on immigration, because apparently they think that immigration ads somehow generate votes for them as Republicans. For example, Claire McCaskill, I know somebody you'd vote for if you were in Missouri, David. Claire McCaskill has ads running against her because she calls for amnesty before securing the border. Now, this is paid for by her Republican GOP process. And they also have some of these ads, David, which are, you know, shadowy characters prowling sidewalks at night as narrators warn of the dangers of sanctuary cities and become reoccurring images in Republican spots. In fact, now you have things like the notorious street gang that the Trump administration has described as public enemy number one coming for you. And it's really amazing when you think about how what we're trying to do. What is this really about? You're trying to scare people into voting for you and make them scared of your typically Democratic opponent and not vote for them. So this is really playing into the politics of fear. How can we scare people into voting? You notice that there's no real policy behind this. There's nothing here that says why this would be good for America. There's nothing here that really talks about how we can proactively deal with things like gangs, how we can proactively deal with asylum seekers from Central America. So rather than going to the source of the problem and how to fix it, what we're seeing is these Republican ads would simply use it to demonize people to get out and vote. It's really interesting to see how this is playing. For example, in Florida, the gubernatorial candidate features his ad where she notes that Trump is building this wall, and DeSantis is literally building a wall with his toddler and say, "Build the wall!" As you know, this is really kind of crazy stuff when you think about it. And yet, last year, when Virginia had their race last November, Ed Gillespie, a well-known moderate Republican, got crushed in the gubernatorial race, and his primary attack and campaign ads for the last month of his race focused on cracking down on MS-13, running a number of ads as part of this. But it's just really part of an ugly and cynical strategy, as America's Voice points out. And I will tell you right here in Georgia, we got Brian Kemp. He of "I'm not quitting my day job to run for governor because I don't want to get paid by the people. And this way I can eliminate voters from the state rolls that might vote against me." Kemp, he ran a campaign ad in the primary of him in his goofy F-350. I'm not even sure that's really his truck, by the way, where he's going to deport criminal illegals and put them in the back of his truck if ICE won't do the job. This is something where only 22% of voters say that immigration is the most important problem in America. Now, that's the highest number in 17 years since this question was asked, but it's really in second place for a lot of voters behind dissatisfaction of the government. Now, it's funny about that. Dissatisfaction with the government that is run completely by Republicans. You have to wonder if people aren't really not paying attention to how this whole thing actually works. When we talk about, because we are now, David, 3 weeks. 3 weeks from today is Election Day. I am going to vote today, David. Are you voting today? I love to vote on Election Day because I love long lines kind of guy. I'm voting today. Our early election started here because I want to be able to get out there and try to convince people that your power of the vote, much like your power to deal with immigration issues, resides with you and your own actions. It doesn't reside with other people. As we put forward these arguments about why immigration is good for America against those that truly detest immigration, that come from the zero population funds, the pro-abortion people, those that are funded by these kind of weird thoughts about what America really is and how to make America white. Very, very much racist, pro-white. That type of sentiment gained a lot of traction under Trump. And we will see, and obviously other GOP guys believe it. That's why they're running ads. A lot of these immigration ads are really race-based ads. Nobody's complaining about the illegal Canadians or the Norwegians that are overstaying their visas or the Brits that are here longer than they should be. And we focus on the brown and black aspects of immigration, which go back to race. We're going to take our first break here on the Immigration Hour on America's Web Radio.
Si usted ha casado con un ciudadano, o tiene problemas con inmigración, o tiene una oferta de trabajo, llama a los abogados de Cook Immigration Partners. Somos en su lado. Con más de 100 años de experiencia en la ley de inmigración, conocemos la ley y sabemos cómo ayudarle. Llámalos hoy a las 404-816-8611, a las 404-816-8611, o visítenos al www.immigration.net.
Whether cruising the strip in a 57 Chevy or taking the family on a vacation in a 71 Oldsmobile Vista Cruiser, you need to tune in to Classic Cars with Steve Ronaldo and Jim Weber every Saturday from 8 to 9 a.m. on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Quick Immigration Partners is your passport through the immigration maze. Whether it's help with E-Verify in your business, or help in how to document a new employee under the new I-9 rules, or if you marry a foreign national, Cook Immigration Partners is your best choice for a legal advocate. Call us today at 866-286-6200. That's 866-286-6200. Or visit us on the web at www.immigration.net.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Immigration Hour on America's Web Radio. It's great to be with you again today. David, I'm just really excited about this election. I think this is going to be a fun election, and I guarantee you that Hillary Clinton's going to win. Oh, wait a second. That was 2 years ago. Who knows what's going to happen in this election?
Did you happen to see that interview?
What is she even giving interviews for? What the heck? Sit down and shut up. I mean, really? Why is this going to be about her and Bill? My God, David. Really? All that does is give Trump fodder for his stupid little infomercials that he runs at these events. Sit down and go sell flowers at a flea market or something. I mean, come on. Stop getting involved. And then Elizabeth Warren, I'm OMG.
I'm an Indian.
OMG. OMG. You know, apparently her political guys thought, let's call Trump on his bluff. Trump was never going to pay you a million. Nobody cares whether Trump lies. Everybody knows Trump lies. So they don't care if he lies. He's never going to pay you $1 million if you prove your... And plus, by the way, since Native Americans don't participate in DNA tests as a body, you can't test whether you have DNA of an American. They compare you against Central Americans and South Americans, which supposedly come from the same genotype, but I don't know. So why even do it? That's just crazy. I mean, come on.
And figured out that she's already crazy?
I mean, come on. It's just... And she does this 3 weeks before the election? Oh, come on. I mean, what have I told you a million times, David? The Democrats could screw up a one-car parade. They could. And they're actually doing it right now. They should be walking away with this election with how many people can't stand Trump. And they're not, because they could screw up a one-person parade. Get these national political figures who think they want to be president, sit down, shut up, let the local races, which are congressional races, let them run, and stop giving fodder to the Democrats. You people are nuts.
To the Republicans.
That's just me, David. That's just how I feel. They're nuts. Well, it's. I was sitting here thinking about the election, because it's just so powerful as part of this process. And with Democrats, you actually never know where they stand. Like Joe Donnelly in Indiana, I'm going to vote for the wall. You know, they've got this. I'm going to vote for the wall. And then you have other Democrats who are generally pro-immigration. But they don't say so because they don't have specific drawn-out policies addressing the flaws in the system. Now, think about this. Somebody said on Facebook the other day, I was complaining about immigration. Well, what's your solution? Now, David, I love when people ask that question, as if I have never proposed a detailed solution to the immigration problem. And I said, well, clearly, you haven't looked at my Facebook page, my Twitter account, my blog, or listen to my podcast where I've talked about this a million times. Why Democrats can't come out with a very specific immigration plan that says, here is what we will do if we are elected, and put it on the table. And it doesn't. You can do this, and I will tell you, most Americans go, yeah. I mean, let's fix it. Rather than demagoguing the issue, let's just fix it. And you and I both know why they don't do this, David. Because they can demagogue the issue. Just like the Republicans demagogue the issue, on the negative side, Democrats can say, hey, we're going to demagogue the issue on the other side. It is really, to me, interesting to see how Democrats are not using immigration as an issue, mostly because a lot of their constituency because immigrants don't vote generally in as high numbers as native-born citizens. And native-born citizens who vote Democrat, it's kind of an important issue, but it's not the most important issue. And therefore, you simply don't talk about it. You simply don't need to really address it. You don't need to bring it out. And as a result, we end up having this terrible situation where we have no solution to a problem that's easily fixable, and we wouldn't have to, at the end of the day, actually deal with this issue for a generation, and it would be good for America. And it just stuns me that it doesn't go there. I do want to mention, David, that the good news is Mike Pence has a solution. Now, you're probably wondering, David, who's Mike Pence?
No, I know exactly.
Oh, you know who Mike Pence is? Okay. You know,
Vice President of the United States.
Oh, you remember that. People kind of forgot who Mike Pence was. So he went to Central America, and he says, we got a solution. Our solution is we're going to make your countries less corrupt. We're going to help you strengthen the rule of law so they don't leave your country. So in the last 3 years, we have given $2.6 billion to foreign assistance to Central America to improve law enforcement and provide job training. And yet, we never try to figure out where that money's actually going. So his solution on immigration is to just give more money without really addressing the central focus of what this problem really is, which is these countries whose people are fleeing. Right now there's a whole caravan again of 1,600 Hondurans that are now walking through Guatemala towards Mexico to seek the protection of the United States in our asylum laws. Why would they not be coming if they could get protection in Guatemala, they could get protection in Mexico, or if they could stay in their own country. Most people I know, now Dave, you know I lived abroad. I lived abroad for a couple of years. I lived in Peru, a very poor country at the time. And I knew some Peruvians that wanted to leave their country for opportunity. But I will tell you, most people, David, the vast majority of Peruvians I met, and since then, Colombians and Mexicans, they don't really have a desire to leave their country because they hate their country. Those that feel the need to leave because of economic issues. They feel they could have a better economic life in the United States. And occasionally there are the political guys, but generally speaking, it's mostly about economics. And so if we spent more focus on the economic development of foreign countries, not necessarily giving them money, but helping them run their own native institutions, like their own federal bank, the Federal Reserve Bank, their own stock markets, their own economic leverages of power, you can really only at that point then have immigration for those that are really fleeing political persecution. And if you help the governments stabilize in all these countries, nobody's going to leave for those reasons either.
Let me ask you something. You're a learned individual, an attorney, and well-respected, and we've got some age under your belt. What you're talking about immigration, and I look at a little bit broader picture even in that, where is the United States, if we've had a failure since day one, what has it been?
If we've had a what since day one?
If we've had a failure since day, I mean, since conception
of the United
States.
Well, I'm a very positive guy, so I generally don't focus on failures. I don't.
Well, let me ask you, though.
Is there a fault in the American experiment, is what you're asking?
Well, yeah, and it is very simple. We have never, ever had a foreign policy. We've had things that we call foreign policies. Probably the Monroe Doctrine is close to a policy.
It was certainly the first foreign policy of the United States after non-interventionism, which was the first foreign policy.
But still, it still comes back to like immigration as a foreign policy.
Oh, immigration is clearly a foreign policy.
And
there's no doubt about that.
We don't know. For some reason, I don't have the answer. I'm asking you. But for some reason, we are not capable of communicating with the rest of the world.
I think we've been a pretty good job up until this presidency of communicating our foreign policy, and that is this kind of pro-democracy, pro-economic freedom argument, at least since the end of World War II. I would suggest, and this is true, I think, for all countries, the foreign policy depends on the leader of the country. I mean, which way does that leader of the country want to bring the country during his or her term in office? And you've seen lots of different countries. You mean, Boris Yeltsin had very different foreign policy than Putin does. Trump has, if Trump has a foreign policy, it's still unclear to me whether she has a foreign policy, other than to say we don't want to be a part of anybody's foreign policy, as than Obama and Bush and Clinton did. But I don't see that as a problem, though. I think that's a strength of democracy. If we think it's important as a country to change our foreign policy, we change our leaders, who then change their foreign policy. Now, I think with Trump, that came as a consequence of not understanding where he stood on any issue whatsoever, other than his own personal enrichment. And certainly it's been difficult for Americans who believe in I don't want to call it a progressive world agenda, but I would say an involved world agenda, where we need to be part of the world's both economic and political movement, and to actually literally step back from that. And I think Obama had a terrible foreign policy in that regard. We're going to lead from behind, whatever the heck that means. But Trump has been no better. I mean, Trump wants to lead, nobody lead at all, let alone from behind. So it seems to me that, I think you're right in one respect, that we don't have a foreign policy and a consistent foreign policy. But I just don't see, and that leads to why we don't really have a consistent immigration policy. Yes, we have immigration laws in the United States, but when the last time that you revised your immigration laws, David, on employment and investment-based immigration was 28, now almost 29 years ago, and the world has changed literally completely in the last 28 years, how can that policy, how can that law be effective in today's world economy? And the answer is simple, David, it's not. And that's why we have these problems that we have. So instead of literally building a wall around America, which does not going to stop anybody from coming here with a visa and overstaying their visas, which is now the largest chunk of people who come to the United States, quote, illegally, we need to have an immigration policy that accurately reflects who we want to come into the United States, and in the way that immigration is good for America. In the next half hour, next segment, we're going to talk about the public charge stuff. I know we talked about that a couple weeks ago, but now that we've had time to digest it a little bit, and we've had time to look at the actual regulation and summarize what the benefits and the detriments are, we can get a really good feeling for how that's going to affect us going forward. But the real problem today is not having an immigration policy that accurately reflects the needs of our economy and our society. There is no reason that Indian nationals should be waiting 150 years for a green card, where a Pakistani national can get his green card in 18 months. There's no sane reason for that in today's world. There is no reason why it should take me, if we're going to allow brothers and sisters to immigrate, why it should take 20 years to immigrate my brothers and sisters. And yet, if I immigrate my parents who then immigrate my siblings, that only takes 15 years or less. It doesn't make a lot of sense in a lot of aspects of the immigration process. It makes no sense why it should take 3 years for the spouse of a permanent resident to immigrate, when it takes a year for the spouse of a citizen to immigrate. And honestly, there's no reason it takes a year. There's no legitimate reason why it takes a year for a citizen to immigrate, other than the general incompetence of the Immigration Service. USCIS a couple weeks ago was touting that they had naturalized the highest number of people in the last 5 years. And what they didn't tout was the fact that we had the longest backlogs for naturalization in a decade, almost 15 years. And that these delays in naturalization are actually harming families who want to finalize their immigration process in the United States. So, you know, kudos to you, Trump administration, for actually doing your job. Bad news for you is that you're literally not doing your job. Let's take a break here on the Immigration Hour on America's Web Radio.
Soy Charles Cook, abogado y jefe del grupo de abogados Cook Immigration Partners. Llámenos hoy si usted tiene problemas con inmigración, si ha sido arrestado, si se casó con un ciudadano o tiene una oferta de trabajo. Nosotros le podemos ayudar. También podemos explicar ¿qué puedes hacer para recibir los beneficios de inmigración? Llámenos hoy a las 404-816-8611, 404-816-8611, o visítenos por el internet al www.immigration.net.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
Cook Immigration Partners is your passport through the immigration maze. Whether it's help with E-Verify in your business, or help in how to document a new employee under the new I-9 rules, or if you marry a foreign national, Cook Immigration Partners is your best choice for a legal advocate. Call us today at 866-286-6200. That's 866-286-6200. Or visit us on the web at www.immigration.net.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Immigration Hour on America's Web Radio. David, a couple weeks ago we were talking about the then publicly released but non-published public charge rule that Stephen Miller and the Know-Nothings in the Trump administration are publishing. Now, what is this? I mean, what does this really mean? Well, we go back to 1996. As part of the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, which restricted immigrants' eligibility for federally funded programs such as Medicaid by imposing a 5-year residency requirement. That is, you had to be a permanent resident for 5 years as an immigrant before you could actually access a large amount of federally funded programs such as Medicaid. And in 1996, Congress also published IRA, which further prohibited immigrants from coming to America as either immigrants or non-immigrants if they were likely to, quote, become a public charge. And what that means is if historically what that's meant, going back to the 1890s, is if you were going to rely on the dole, whether you were going to be a net taker rather than a net contributor to society. And actually the law in Section 212 of the Immigration Nationality Act gives a great deal of leverage to the Department of State in whether a prospective immigrant is actually going to become a public charge. The USCIS or DHS is now publishing this rule to give us their interpretation. There had been a previous attempt at a rule which ended up becoming a policy because it never really went through the full Federal Register process, but which really made the public charge ground sealed within a thing called an affidavit of support. So, David, here is this law. Here's what it says. If you're an intending immigrant to America, you want to come to America and immigrate, and you're being sponsored by family, your sponsoring family member must sign an affidavit, which is actually a contract between you, the prospective immigrant who's coming, and the U.S. government. And this agreement does a number of things. One, it says if this prospective immigrant illegally uses or improperly uses public benefits for 10 years after their entry as a permanent resident or up until they become a citizen, which can be 5 years, then you, as the sponsor, agree to pay the federal government back. You're also required, as the sponsor of this document, as the signer of this document, to show that you have earned in the previous year at least 125% of poverty level income for your family size plus the immigrant. So here's how that works. Poverty level income, 125% of poverty level income is about $15,800 a year. So if one person sponsoring an immigrant, you must have made on your tax return about $21,000. If you're sponsoring two people, you must have made $26,000. If you have two people in your family sponsoring one, that's three. You must have made 26,000. If you're sponsoring three people and you have two in your family, you must have made 35. So every additional person either in your family under the age of 21 or your spouse plus that immigrant, you have to raise up by $5,000. And you have to show your most previous year, and sometimes your previous 3 years, tax returns to show that you make that money. Or if you're retired, you don't make that amount of money, but you have assets, liquid assets that can show your ability to sustain a person, then you can show that as well. That basically has been the de facto answer to public charge. So if you have, if you're being sponsored by your spouse or your parents or your children, and that person makes enough money, then you were, then they basically said, okay, you're not going to be a public charge. Now, here's the deal that's interesting, David. To my knowledge, the U.S. government has never exercised its rights under an affidavit of support to seek payment for improperly disbursed federal funds, likely because it's virtually impossible to obtain those improperly disbursed federal funds because of the SAVE system, in which the states which disperse most of these funds have to check and see whether you're an authorized immigrant for purposes of receiving the money. So for that reason, the money hasn't come out. Now, what if you don't make enough money as a sponsor? Well, then you can have a co-sponsor. Now, the statute itself does not limit you as to who can be your co-sponsor. Well, it can be a family member, like a brother who's not sponsoring you. It could be your parent who's not sponsoring you. But you can also be a friend. And over the years, people have used their boss, their friends, to be a co-sponsor when the petitioning person is not making the money. An example of that today, David, is a kid who turns 21 can sponsor their parents if those parents enter the country legally at some point. But that kid may be in school. Therefore, he doesn't make any money. So that parent then talks to a brother who then signs for them. Now, the Department of State has taken the position over the last several months that if that sponsor is not really a close relative of yours, what is his incentive to actually sponsor you? Well, the incentive is it's a legal requirement. I can sue over it. Okay. And the feds can. But they've said at least to some people, well, you know, your employer signed it, but, you know, I don't really believe they're going to sponsor you. They're going to deny you. They're going to public charge. That doesn't make any sense, considering it's a legally binding contract between you, the government, and that person, but there it is. Well, that apparently wasn't enough for Stephen Miller and his band of nativist misfits who now currently run DHS. So they have come out with the public charge regulations, and they have now published these items in the Federal Register last Wednesday. And it's now open for a 60-day comment period. There's lots of... Honestly, if this is a topic that interests you, you should send in a comment. But let's take a look at what they're doing here. They want to change, this document wants to change the definition of public charge in a way that has repercussions for health care access for any immigrant families and potentially for the health of U.S. citizens as well. Now, there are some classes of immigrants that are exempted from public charge, such as refugees and asylees, but those numbers are insignificant compared to the overall number of immigrants in America. So we talked about the PRWRA, the Perora, about restricting access in 96 until you've imposed a five-year residence requirement in the United States. Now, state-funded programs to preserve eligibility, such as those in California, ameliorated some negative effects, but many of those eligible were discouraged from enrolling and seeking care out of fear that it might affect their immigration status or that of a family member. Because of those effects, the Immigration Service issued clarifying guidance in 1999 stating, okay, only government cash assistance could be considered in the public charge assessment. So if you got Medicare, Medicaid, TANF, WIC, those weren't cash benefits, and therefore you were not a public charge if you used those. Thus, immigrants could still be eligible for Medicaid, for health care, other non-cash benefits like food stamps, WIC, and without jeopardizing their status. Then the Affordable Care Act passed. Now, the Affordable Care Act excludes undocumented immigrants until they have maintained their five-year residence requirement. Even so, research found that nationally, the ACA closed the coverage gap between U.S.-born and naturalized citizens and non-citizen immigrants, particularly in states that expanded Medicaid. Why would the threat of being labeled a public charge deter immigrants from enrolling in Medicaid? Because for the most part, immigrants are younger and healthier than the U.S. population overall. Health insurance, therefore, seems less urgent than does the job. Faced with the proposed rule that's going out there, many will forego now enrolling in Medicaid and other publicly funded benefits if they fear it will affect their ability to work legally in the United States. And that's true particularly for those with children. So your children might be eligible. In Georgia, we have a thing called Peach Care that for kids, and generally to be a U.S. citizen. These kids are born in the States. Their parents may be undocumented. They may be permanent residents. They will not enroll their kids in Peach Care, a legal right of these children as U.S. citizens, for fear that the parents might be ruled to be a public charge. And I'll give you a great example of that. So let's say the kid's born in the United States. Parents came here, 20 years ago. 3 or 4 years ago, when the kid was 16, they got sick. They enrolled in Peach Care. The kid got the treatment. The kid's fine. The kid's now 21. Sponsors mom and dad. They asked mom and dad, did you ever apply for any benefits? Well, I applied for my child. What'd you apply for? I applied for Peach Care. Oh, I'm sorry. You're going to be a public charge because you have been one in the past. Bam, you're denied. So the ability of that parent to legally immigrate is now gone because their child, who needed medical care and who was legally entitled to the medical care and insurance of the state, used it, therefore depriving the parent of their right to use it. That seems monumentally stupid and not really forward-looking, and certainly I think would be detrimental to the public health of the United States. Medicaid and other publicly funded health services are absolutely critical to most immigrant populations because immigrants are more likely to be working than non-immigrants, and they also more likely to work in jobs that do not provide health insurance and pay low wages, even, David, in the era of the ACA. Right now, 25% of non-elderly authorized immigrants have Medicaid or children's health insurance coverage. Research says that immigrants' lack of health insurance leads to reduced access to care and poorer quality care for them and their citizen children. This could put all of them at risk for deteriorating health. I'll give you a great example, Dave. When I was working as a pastor of my Spanish congregation a few years ago, I had a woman who was in the United States from Venezuela, and she was undocumented. Her husband had gone to jail because he was committed a crime for which he should have gone to jail, and he was going to be deported. She had two children, one born in the U.S. and one not born in the United States. And those kids, the one not born here had come here when he was about five. The one born here was now 10. Neither one of those children had seen a doctor or a dentist in the entire time they had been in the United States. Not once. That is not good for the overall public health of the U.S. Now, here's the kicker, David. In their proposed regulations, DHS acknowledges that many immigrants and U.S. citizens will be affected by the rule, noting the following negative effects, including, quote, worse health. Because we're publishing this rule, there will be worse health outcomes. Increased use of emergency rooms, which David, is the that's the insurance policy for people who have insurance. It's an emergency room, right? Increased emergency room. Increased prevalence of communicable diseases. Nobody's going to get vaccines. Increase in uncompensated care. Increased rates of poverty and housing instability. And reduced productivity and educational attainment. And yet, even acknowledging that, yes, all these things are going to happen if we do this rule, they're still going to do the rule. OMG! How does that make any sense at all? Now, here's how it makes sense, David. It makes sense if you hate immigrants. It makes sense if you don't want immigrants in America. It makes sense if you think immigrants are bad for America. So therefore, it makes perfect sense to the Steve Miller's nativist minions who are now running this policy. Basically, this is a backdoor attempt to reduce legal immigration. But using health policy to reduce legal immigration is a wildly bad idea. And, I want to thank you. There's a good argument on this. This actually comes from the RAND Corporation, who has great numbers on this. Catherine Pitkin DeRose, I would encourage you to go read what RAND has to say about this, which is a nonpartisan research organization, to really learn how bad this rule would be. I encourage you to go out, look at the rule in the register, send in your comment, and we will go from there. We'll be back shortly on this after this break on the Immigration Hour on America's Web Radio.
Soy Charles Cook, el jefe del grupo de abogados Cook Immigration Partners. Estoy en su lado. Con más de 20 años de experiencia con la ley de inmigración, conozco cómo ayudarle. Sé la ley y sé que alguna gente podemos ayudar. Llámanos hoy a las 404-816-8611, a las 404-816-8611, o visítenos en el internet www.immigration.net.
Whether cruising the strip in a 57 Chevy or taking the family on a vacation in a 71 Oldsmobile Vista Cruiser, you need to tune in to Classic Cars with Steve Ronaldo and Jim Weber every Saturday from 8 to 9 a.m. on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Cook Immigration Partners is your passport through the immigration maze. Whether it's help with E-Verify in your business, or help in how to document a new employee under the new I-9 rules, or if you marry a foreign national, Cook Immigration Partners is your best choice for a legal advocate. Call us today at 866-286-6200. That's 866-286-6200, or visit us on the web at www.immigration.net.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to our last segment on today's Immigration Hour, David. David, you know, we've talked previously. We had on our show a couple weeks ago Marty Rosenbluth, the lawyer. And there's a great article on him. On him. The only lawyer in this one-horse town. Really terrific article in The Guardian. I would encourage all our listeners to go read it. Marty is a, you know, Marty's a really good lawyer, but more importantly, David, he's a terrific human being, just a really good man, and I am proud to call him a friend. I just, somebody even commented, it reached out to me about our show with Marty and said, God, I love that guy. He's such a good human being. So recently, David, there has been another death in an immigration detention center. So there was an immigrant detainee in an immigration detention center, which is called Harmonsworth. And in this immigration detention center, this is this is actually over in Europe, this guy had a, he was threatening to kill himself, and he was in severe pain, and they decided in a meeting with staff that the guy really had a toothache. And they gave him a couple aspirin, sent him back to his room, and 3 days later, he hung himself. That's happening in detention centers around the world and happening here in the United States. And it's sad that we continue to have immigration detention centers in the United States which are privately run, which are run for profit, and which therefore take a very hard line on medical treatment for these guys that are in there. In the Stewart Detention Center, we've had four people in the last couple of years that have died, either of, quote, natural causes or because they killed themselves because of mistreatment. The standard policy in Stewart is if you are a complainer, you complain too much about your physical issues or mental health issues, to treat you, they put you in solitary confinement. David, I know you've never been in solitary confinement. Can you imagine how that affects somebody who's already mentally ill? And then they apparently have stuff in there you can kill yourself with. I mean, yeah, this is almost akin to actually murdering somebody. It's awful. Now, David, I want to switch here for the last part of the show to Justice Kavanaugh. Now, I know you were deeply involved in watching all this stuff on television, and Kavanaugh, to me, apart from the issues about him, always struck me as kind of a political hack. He was clearly deeply involved with the Clinton saga. He had some very interesting points of view on deposing Bill Clinton and what should be asked. And clearly, I don't know if you know this, David, but he took him 3 years to be confirmed to the Court of Appeals. He just kept getting renominated by George Bush year after year after year. And he finally got on the court. And I think that was back in 2004, 2005 when he got put on the Court of Appeals. But what always struck me was, from an immigration perspective, what was Judge Kavanaugh like on the Court of Appeals at the D.C. Circuit on immigration. Well, there are very few decisions on immigration that he was a part of or that he wrote. I think there was only three that he actually wrote, and not a whole lot more that he was a part of his 320 decisions, something like that, while he was in the Court of Appeals. But he always struck me as kind of an ideologue on this issue. Well, David, it turns out that I was right. Justice Kavanaugh was sworn in on Sunday, and he participated in his first immigration argument on Wednesday of last week. Now, this immigration argument was about a statute. So, David, back in 1996, Congress wrote a statute that said that when somebody detain somebody, quote, upon their release. So if you get, Dave, you're an immigrant and you get charged with shoplifting and you get sentenced to a year in jail, the statute says upon your release, you are to be mandatorily detained by the Immigration Service. And it's really interesting. Now, Gorsuch's philosophy on justice was, David, do you know what it was? What his view of the Constitution was? I will tell you that he was an originalist. What was the language of the what does the language of the Constitution allow? And he was also a textualist in the context of when a statute says something, you rely upon those words. You know, it's not your job to interpret what Congress meant. It's not your job to determine what were they feeling about it. The statute says what it says. You interpret the plain language of the statute. That was Gorsuch's philosophy as stated in his confirmation hearings in the 2000s and again this year. So this statute comes along, and the statute itself is it says that upon release from criminal custody, the federal law requires detention without an opportunity for a bail hearing. And so this question became this. What does that mean? Well, Gorsuch, certainly not a guy to hide behind anybody else's coattails, he started questioning the lawyer challenging, well, actually, it's the federal government that's appealing the case, but that the argument has been interpreted to mean upon release means if ICE does not pick up a person either immediately or very shortly after his detention, then that person is eligible for a bond hearing in front of a judge, an immigration judge. And now the Supreme Court is deciding whether the circuits that have ruled that way, which is all the circuits so far, actually means that ICE only has a very short window to pick somebody up from custody. And if they don't do it, let's say, David, you have a 1999 conviction for selling marijuana, and they don't pick you up. They come today, and they pick you up today. Do you get a bond hearing? And the argument in favor of giving a bond hearing is, well, you didn't pick me up upon release. Well, Gorsuch said this. What was really going through Congress's mind in 1996 was the harshness on the topic. Gorsuch suggested that mandatory detention of immigrants long after their completed sentences could be problematic in that is there any limit to the government's power? But this is really interesting. Gorsuch was really focusing on, does this apply regardless of the time? And the government says, yes. Basically, at the end of the day, Congress's answer was enough is enough. If you're an alien, you come here, you commit one of these crimes, you forfeited whatever right you have to remain at large in the country, community, no matter when that conviction occurred. So that's Gorsuch that said this. Kavanaugh, however, questioned what is on Congress's mind. What did Congress intend? Not the plain language of the statute. So you have Gorsuch, who is truly a textualist, and now you have Kavanaugh, because it doesn't fit his model on immigration enforcement, and he's very much an anti-immigration guy based upon the stuff he wrote previously. You may have, David, a 5-4 decision in which Gorsuch is once again the swing vote, much like he was in a case this last spring when he joined the court's 4 liberal members in striking down a law that allowed the government to deport some immigrants who had serious crimes, saying it was unconstitutionally vague. This is really interesting. So the law says this: the federal authorities shall take into custody any alien convicted of certain crimes, some serious and some minor, when the alien is released. The key word, David, is when.
What does the word when mean? Is this has the same definition as is? What does the word when mean? David, the word for when, for you, is very time specific. For me, it's when that happens. It's a date and time when that happens. And
the government lawyer is arguing that, oh, no, when could be, you know, whenever you want to. But the thing is, this would mean, if the court interpreted this to mean, David, that regardless of when you finish your sentence, the minute ago they pick you up, 20 years ago, that when you are picked up, you get mandatory detention, do you know how many more beds we're going to need? Tens of thousands. If there's no bond for anybody who has a criminal offense, minor or not minor, you know how much money that's going to cost the federal government? This, David, is a nightmare in the making. So my prediction is that Gorsuch will side with the quote liberal minority, which is really oddly enough the pro liberty minority. Hey, everybody should be found to be in favor of liberty, in favor of letting somebody remain at liberty while they're contesting the charges against them. And it suggests to me that Kavanaugh is going to be a solid, super solid conservative voice on this court for a very, very long time. When in reality, the idea was, well, maybe he'll be, you know, a centrist. No, this guy is definitely as conservative as they come. And this was pointed out within the first 2 days of his oral argument. So we'll see how this turns out. David, we'll have another show on the result of that case, probably in the spring sometime. You know, they tend to take a little while to write these decisions. It's interesting. One last thing on that. Kavanaugh said this. The problem is that Congress did not trust those bond hearings. Congress was concerned that those hearings were not working in the way that Congress wanted, and therefore a certain class of criminal or terrorist aliens said no more. Wow. So now Kavanaugh is deeply involved in congressional intent. I'm going to be curious, David, if he takes this position with other statutes with which he doesn't agree, and how they should be interpreted. It's going to be happening. Interesting to see that whatever's happening today. Cecilia Wang, who argued this case, said, "With controversy over so-called sanctuary jurisdiction, doesn't really shed light on what Congress wanted in '96." Thank you, Cecilia Wang. Great argument in court. David, it's been good to be back here. We'll be back next week on the Immigration Hour on America's Web Radio.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Cook Immigration Partners is your passport through the immigration maze. Whether it's help with E-Verify in your business, or help in how to document a new employee under the new I-9 rules, or if you marry a foreign national, Cook Immigration Partners is your best choice for a legal advocate. Call us today at 866-286-6200. That's 866-286-6200, or visit us on the web at www.immigration.net.
Get your pen and paper ready. If there's a move in your near future, I'm here to tell you that the folks I used and now recommend is Around Town Movers. Timothy and the guys recently moved me, and I am and was totally satisfied with a sometimes not so fun experience moving. Call Timothy at 770-378-4708 and make it a good move and a good experience. Around Town Movers, for that local or cross-country move. Timothy, Around Town Movers, in my opinion, are the best. That's Around Town Movers. Call them.
Perhaps you are struggling to cope with the disease of addiction. If not, you probably know a family member or friend that needs help in battling the cravings and the personal and professional damage done by the effects of drugs or alcohol. Get a pen and paper and be ready to write down the following. These are the issues that the trained staff at the Atlanta Healing Center address and treat every day. Their doctors and counselors with over 40 years of practice in the field of addiction can treat the suffering individual in a thoughtful, compassionate, and experienced manner and guide him or her along the path to recovery. So call 770-699-